Hello, good afternoon, and welcome to Joy, today's episode of Resounding Echoes. Apologies if my voice is not the best today. I came down with something a few days ago, but I will try to do my best. Today's program was all set to be a short and joyous affair. That was until last Monday, the 21st, when I read something very disappointing and unacceptable on this website. It is saddening and frustrating that in 2024 I have to do this, but as I have a voice, I have to. So let's go. Here on Classical Music Daily, readers are given the daily and very welcome opportunity to read or reread articles that were published on that very date from 25 and 20 years ago. From the 24th of October 1999, last Monday, one could read, now thankfully corrected, the following sentence in reference to the Irish town of Wexford and its opera festival. I quote, "It's difficult to imagine a more cosy, enjoyable and hospitable corner of the British Isles in which to savour opera's arcane delights." End of quote. The fact that such a sentence was written and published in an international space a mere 18 months after the historic Good Friday Agreement speaks volumes about the shameful and depressing lack of political awareness and sensitivity of both the person who typed it and the editor who published it unchallenged. To refer to a town that is uniquely part of the sovereign state of the Republic of Ireland and solely part of the geographical entity of the island of Ireland as part of the British Isles is no less objectionable nor illogical than referring to Cambridge as part of the Irish Isles. Whilst many British people, clearly including the writer of said article, see no issue with or reason to jettison the former, I would imagine that the very same people would take enormous exception to the latter, indeed see it as ludicrous, as indeed it is. So why the difference? Well, as I have shown that they are equally illogical, the only reason for such difference can be one of familiarity, convenience, precedence, inertia, and a historically comfortable complacency that sees no necessity, less so any moral duty, to change ways of thinking and talking in harmony with a radically changed post-colonial reality. The result of growing up in an imperial or post-imperial society with a corresponding education system which has done little or nothing to educate the children of the home country about the full reality and nefarious implications of British imperialism, especially from the perspective of the now ex-colonies and their native populations. And thus, seeing no good reason to change their way of thinking or talking, as children of an empire numb to the reality of colonialism, they don't. Their smug sense of entitlement to continue to use the term the British Isles in whatever context they see fit, part of their hubristic heritage of imperialism, clearly matters more to them than being factually correct or a desire to avoid causing offence. 10 years ago, a survey was published which revealed that 60% of British people think of the British Empire and its legacy with pride. I don't think British people are any better or worse than anyone else on this planet. People are people. Where they come from is irrelevant. So for that reason, I don't believe that the result of this survey means that half or more of the British population are completely indifferent to human suffering and gross injustice on a massive scale over numerous centuries. I think rather that this survey shows that a large percentage of British people are just totally ignorant about the reality of the British Empire, and to quote the title of Caroline Elkin's 2022 meticulously researched book on the subject, Its Legacy of Violence. A truly shocking account of what happened again and again and again and again, almost by default, that could just as easily have been titled Legacy of Sadism, Legacy of Criminality, Legacy of Inhumanity, Legacy of Moral Hypocrisy, Legacy of Hubris, Legacy of Benighted Wishful Thinking, or to borrow a term she coins in the book herself, Legacy of Legalized Lawlessness. I have encountered this ignorance many times. When the all too negative aspects of British-Irish relations, or lack of, featured almost daily on news broadcasts throughout the 70s, 80s and 90s, I have lost count of the number of British people I have spoken to over the years who have little or no knowledge of or even interest in the root causes of what were referred to as the Troubles. Many who seem so keen to hang on to the term the British Isles in reference to Ireland are almost always the very people who know nothing about Ireland and its more than seven centuries of entanglement with England and later Britain. This ignorance was also made evident in the more recent Brexit debacle, when it became clear that very few, if any, of those who wanted Britain to leave the European Union gave a moment's thought to how Brexit would impact on Northern Ireland, the lives of its citizens, or its relations with the Republic of Ireland, a proud member of the European Union, an ignorance proven by the ensuing Brexit-caused chaos in said region. I once lived in a small, very pleasant village in Cambridgeshire, and I will never forget the first time I went into the local library and stood in front of its discreet history shelving. I was presented with section after section after section devoted to the Nazis, much less about the Second World War as a whole. Surprisingly few books in comparison about the First World War, a couple about Roman Britain, nothing on the Norman Conquest or the Williamite invasion. There was a book about Thomas Cromwell, but nothing on Oliver or the English Civil War as a whole. And apart from a biography of Nelson, nothing specific about the eight centuries of British global imperium, whether in reference to Ireland, India, North America, Africa, the transatlantic slave trade, or the penal colony of Australia. Nothing. When people say that the British Isles is merely a geographical term and politically neutral in its modern usage, anyone with even a minimal knowledge of British and Irish history or colonialism more generally and a matching degree of understanding and sensitivity should know that the word British can never, ever be neutral in any context relating to Ireland and can only be political. And for citizens of the Republic of Ireland, which includes Wexford, and many in Northern Ireland, exclusively negative and deeply offensive, a stubborn, ungracious, and dismissive hangover from imperial thinking, which many British people see no reason or have no desire to jettison. Why? Ask yourselves how Norwegians or the Danes would feel if Scandinavia was referred to as the Swedish Peninsula, or what the Portuguese would think if the Iberian was renamed the Spanish Peninsula, as indeed it once was. If Benelux became the Dutch states, do you think the Belgians and Luxembourgers would accept the argument that it is just a geographical and politically neutral term? If it's neutral, why not let's just call said territory the Irish Isles? The term the British Isles in reference to any part of the world that is not a part of British sovereign territory is purely an imperialist term. As I said in What's in a Name, naming is owning. It is very revealing that the people who are so keen to say that it is just a word are seemingly so reluctant to abandon it. If it is just a word, just drop it. The use of Great Britain and Ireland as a substitute for the British Isles when talking about things that the two islands have in common, such as climate or geology, is deemed too vague or too cumbersome. It is likewise telling that not being precise, comfortable, or familiar enough is seen as more important and a more valid reason for not adopting a new term than being factually correct or sensitive to other ways of thinking. So to be clear, Wexford, politically, is uniquely part of the Republic of Ireland, on Phoblacht na Héireann, and geographically, uniquely part of the island of Ireland, Éire. To use the term the British Isles in relation to anything Irish is factually erroneous and displays an unacceptable degree of ignorance, insensitivity and facetiousness. For any British listeners, if for whatever reason you want to refer to the islands of Great Britain and Ireland as a whole in some context, you could do so just like that. Great Britain and Ireland. Easy. And next time you want to wave your Union Jack with pride, a British, not an English flag, or sing along to Rule Britannia, please, before you do so, educate yourselves as to what was done around the world under the proud auspices of that flag and what that very Britannic rule meant for the people in so-called British colonies. You could do a lot worse than starting by reading Caroline Elkin's Legacy of Violence, a book that should be mandatory reading on every history curriculum in schools throughout the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. If you read that book and remain proud of the legacy of the British Empire, I will say no more and leave you to enjoy your opinions. There are those who maintain what, for want of a better term, I will call an antiques roadshow view of the British Empire, and will say to me, it wasn't all bad, as if the immense but ill-gotten gains for the home country and some of its residents redeem or reduce the catalogue of nightmares required to provide such positives. I have also encountered the same mentality too often in Ireland, in relation to the supposedly isolated cases of Catholic priests who sexually abuse children within a Catholic church edifice that bends over backwards to protect the abusers and not the abused. And I ask myself, why are some people so desperate and determined to belittle clearly criminal and immoral behaviour and exonerate those responsible rather than ashamedly acknowledging such wrongdoing and seeking justice and some kind of compensation for those abused? Anyway, on with today's show. I said it before in a piece I wrote last year called Turn That Racket Down, that one of the great joys of 20th century music was the unleashing and full utilization of the immense potential of a symphony orchestra's percussion section. So by way of acknowledgement of this pulsating phenomenon, I am going to let that very section of the symphony orchestra strike up today's program. From the visceral joy of rhythm to that of the enraptured entwining of words and music, let's have our first emission of joy for today.
Joy always, joy everywhere.
Words by Carl Sandburg, music by Ruth Crawford. From the joy of settings to the somewhat more dubious joys of the bottle, which enables us all to be legends in our own minds, gods in our own heaven and hell, and provides an apparent, all too easy excuse for the almost always inexcusable, conveniently allowing the placing of blame on the glass in your hand and absolving from any wrongdoing the glass on your wall. From wine-kindled fantasies to the intangible texture of dream, as imagined by a young man floating free from the abode of adolescence and already sounding quite unlike anybody else. Les Cent Impalpables du Rêve, the fifth of Olivier Messiaen's Prelude of 1929. I could have chosen to play an excerpt from the sixth of the set of eight pieces, but that would have been spoiling you too much, and maybe would have warranted some kind of advisory warning at the top of the program. For those of you with a strong enough constitution and a matching appetite for immense and undiluted joy, I will let you discover that piece for yourselves, if you dare, and of course, if you don't already know it. The earlier prelude was written by a young man in a very old world, as was that string quartet. So by way of contrast, let's have another prelude, this time one from a young woman reveling in the new. Thank you. That was taken from the last of Ruth Crawford's nine preludes of 1929, from the same neck of the woods and the same year, but from an older generation. My next piece is likewise dedicated to all those who still think that the most essential attribute necessary to be a truly great composer is the possession of a penis. Notwithstanding our percussive prelude, I started today's program with a reflection on joy, and I'm going to finish it off with another joyous outpouring. Ich lebe und weiß nicht wie lang, ich sterbe und weiß nicht wann, ich gehe und weiß nicht wohin, doch mich wundert's trotzdem nicht, dass ich trotzdem fühlisch bin. I am alive, but I don't know for how long. I will die, and I don't know when. I go on, but I don't know where. But I'm not at all surprised that I am full of joy. Words and Music by Ernst Krenek from his Journey Through the Austrian Alps. And that's it for today. I could call today's program a game of two halves, only it's not a game. Thank you for listening. Until next time, take care and keep tuning in for those resounding echoes.